So good afternoon. I'm very pleased that you are here at the last lecture of the clinical endocrinology elective of Semmelweis University. And we have chosen one topic for this lecture, and this topic is pheochromocytoma. And you will understand why we have chosen this topic, because it is really a clinically very challenging disorder, and I hope that you will understand at the end of the lecture that why I'm saying that this is really a clinically challenging disorder. You probably know from your previous lectures that one of the main symptoms of pheochromocytoma is of hypertension. And you also know that hypertension is a quite frequent disorder in the general population. In some age, it reaches almost 15 or 20% of the subject. And pheochromocytoma accounts for a very small proportion of the hypertension population. And if you look at the epidemiological data, you will find that the prevalence of pheochromocytoma in the hypertensive population is not more than 0.01 and between 0.01 and 0.5%. But which is really a low number. But when we look at the autopsy data, it shows something different. And we have two large studies which involve 2,031 autopsies and 2,140 autopsies, one from Australia and one from Hong Kong. And they found that one pheo per 2,000 or more than 2,000 person. So probably it is not as rare as we think from these prevalence data. Now we have some precise studies when they really examine the incidence of the pheochromocytoma, and this is from 7 age in from the mid 90s from Sweden, which indicated that the number of patients with pheochromocytoma, it's about 2 per 1 million per year. If you calculate this for the Hungarian population, it's about 20 newly recognized pheochromocytoma in 1 year, which is not a large number. And the same results showed in another study from Spain, which is about also 2 per million people per year. But one other figure what you should reconsider, that the number of clinically unrecognized pheochromocytomas are in some studies very high. So I show you just the result of a combined studies of what was published in between 1950 and 1989, that the clinically unrecognized pheochromocytomas reached from 17 to 74% of all pheochromocytoma patients. So we can say that a considerable proportion of pheochromocytomas are not clinically recognized. And we may guess that some of the pheochromocytomas diagnosed only at autopsy. Now, what are the key features what we should first review in pheochromocytoma? And why is it important for the recognition and proper treatment of the patient? And we can say that it is somehow connected with catecholamine overproduction. And those points are which we should consider why the pheochromocytoma, recognition of the pheochromocytoma is so important, because this is a potentially lethal disorder if it is undiagnosed and untreated. And because complications may be present, and those complications may precede diagnosis. And some of the complications are listed here, and some others are also can be present. Those are cerebrovascular accident, circulatory shock, left ventricular failure, pulmonary edema, and so on. So the patient can die from disorders or may have a long-term morbidity from those complications. It is also that important to note that if the patient are properly diagnosed and treated, then it is possible that the patient have a long-term cure. So it is a curable disorder if we make a proper diagnosis and the patient is properly treated. Now we just, it is not a physiology lecture, but just for the introduction, we should talk about something for the catecholamines, and I will just review those data which are very important from a clinical point of view. And this is a combined data from the catecholamine production, which take place in the adrenal and also we know in the sympathetic ganglia. And also it shows the effect of different catecholamines and also the metabolism of catecholamines, which are very important from clinical point of view. And I will just look over the few clinically important points. So probably you cannot see here, but this is the precursor of catecholamines. It is thyroxine, and it is an enzymatic step. The next step is dopamine, which is produced from tyrosine. And this is a precursor of the norepinephrine, which is a true catecholamine. And the next one step is synthetic step to produce epinephrine. You see also that the organization of the adrenal medulla is that it is within the adrenal gland. You also know from your physiology studies that the blood flow in the adrenal comes from the venous blood flow, comes from the outer part of the adrenal to the inner part. So glucocorticoids, which are produced in the adrenal cortex, which in a very high concentration in the adrenal medulla. Why is it important to emphasize in the clinical point of view? Because this enzyme which converts norepinephrine to epinephrine, this is induced by high concentration of catecholamines. So when a tumor develops in the catecholamine-producing tumor within the adrenal, the high concentration of glucocorticoids which are coming from the adrenal cortex will induce this enzyme. The abbreviation is PNMT enzyme, and the whole name is phenylmethylunsulfatase. And this enzyme induction will convert norepinephrine to epinephrine. Why is it important to know? Because we know that also pheochromocytomas can develop from the sympathetic ganglia, where glucocorticoid concentration is low. So pheochromocytomas, which are produced in which are developed in the adrenal gland, will produce epinephrine, while sympathetic ganglia produce only norepinephrine, and tumors deriving from the sympathetic ganglia produce only norepinephrine because of the lack of high concentration of glucocorticoids. So it is very important, because if we find a patient which has only norepinephrine overproduction, we can expect an extra adrenal pheochromocytoma. When norepinephrine and epinephrine is increased, we can expect and we can look for the adrenals to find the tumor. Now we turn back to the action of the catecholamines. You will notice that nearly all organs are affected with catecholamines, and you can see that the blue line, which is norepinephrine, and the red line shows that and the effect of catecholamines in different organs. And you also know that they have different potency, those two catecholamines, on the different organs. So norepinephrine is very important and very potent to increase blood pressure, while, for example, adrenaline or epinephrine is more effective on the liver to produce glucose from glycogen. So the diabetes, which is can be a part of the symptoms in pheochromocytoma, is present, or we expect it's present in catecholamine producing pheochromocytomas, which are producing epinephrine, and not on those which produce norepinephrine. Now we turn back to the metabolism of catecholamines, and we can measure metabolites in the urine. And very important point that if you follow again the red line and the blue line, you will see that in the urine, epinephrine and its metabolite metanephrine is present. Also in the urine present norepinephrine and its metabolite metanephrine. And one other catecholamine metabolite is the abbreviation VMA. This is vanillin mandelic acid, which can come from both norepinephrine and epinephrine. So when we measure VMA, then we cannot know that it comes from epinephrine or norepinephrine, so we cannot know that we can expect ordinal origin or extraordinal origin pheochromocytomas. So this was just for the short introduction. And so some repeats, so catecholamines, norepinephrine, epinephrine, dopamine. Norepinephrine, again, typical to extraordinal pheochromocytomas. Epinephrine is typical to ordinal pheochromocytomas. And some tumors may produce dopamine, but dopamine overproduction has less clinical effects and probably not much significance in clinical practice. Also, we were talking about catecholamine metabolites, so metanephrine and normetanephrine. And we also have to know that those metabolites can be produced within the tumor. So there are really some studies which show that with large tumors, which we think that they have a much more potency to metabolize catecholamines, those tumors will produce metabolites and not catecholamines because of the large size of the tumor. Again, VMA is a metabolite from both norepinephrine and epinephrine. So again, we cannot tell from VMA that it comes from, catecholamines come from the adrenal or extraadrenal sources. And there are sulfoconjugated catecholamines also, but those catecholamines in clinical diagnosis, we can say that those are really not very important to measurement. Now about the main symptoms, we were talking already that the main symptom, one of the main symptoms in hypertension, and it's important to know that what kind of hypertension we find in patients. We find that in 40% of the patients, the hypertension is stable, so the patient is constantly hypertensive, but in 50% of patients, the patient developed typical paroxysmal hypertension, which is associated with other symptoms, and those symptoms are listed here. So usually when a paroxysm occurs, then the patient had headache, palpitation, increased perspiration, sweating, and also very typical for pheochromocytoma patient that during those attacks, the patient are very pale. And this is quite different from another patients with essential hypertension who have usually a reddish face. One what we should also say that about 10% of patients with pheochromocytoma do not have hypertension. But even in those cases, we don't know that any time with a provocation or without provocation can develop a hypertensive crisis, and the patient may die suddenly or may have severe complication. So this is, I can say, a general rule. If we diagnose a pheochromocytoma, this should be treated, and the treatment is adrenalectomy if we find the pheochromocytoma. And for adrenal pheochromocytoma, today the preferred treatment is laparoscopic surgery. Now I already mentioned, and the previous slide showed those main symptoms like headache, sweating, palpitation, pallor, nausea and palpitation, but there are several other symptoms which are less frequent than those, and you find here very different symptoms, and from chest pain to flushing even. I said this is some contradiction that patients usually have a pale skin, but flushing can also present, and the probably explanation for this that sometimes the symptoms are very strange, and really we can say the pheochromocytoma considering symptoms, this is a big actor, because pheochromocytomas can produce other hormones and biogenic amines other than catecholamines, and those hormone production can cause very unusual symptoms. And here are some examples here. For example, if the pheochromocytoma very rarely producing ACTH, then we find symptoms of Cushing syndrome. You heard before about this disorder. Or if the pheochromocytome produce very rarely interleukin-6, then we find very strange symptoms like fever, inflammation marker increase. So the patient looks like a patient with a malignant disorder, and the pheochromocytoma not necessarily malignant, but we will return the question of malignancy. Now, then if someone wants to give a proposal, we said that patient, there are many, many patients for hypertension. Who should we screen about those patients? And there are two proposals that we should follow. If the patient has paroxysmal hypertension with typical attacks, we should consider pheochromocytoma. And even if the patient has stable hypertension, but the hypertension is resistant to treatment, we should look also for pheochromocytoma. We know also that pheochromocytoma attack can be provoked by different intervention, and the most common cause for this intervention which producing pheochromocytoma attack are during anesthesia or surgery or even angiography. So if a severe hypertension or even unexplained hypotension develops during anesthesia or surgery or angiography, we should consider and should look for a pheochromocytoma in those patients. Very important, and we will very briefly to talk about the familial forms of pheochromocytomas. And if the patient has a family history of pheochromocytoma or have a suspicion for hereditary syndromic pheochromocytoma, we should look for pheochromocytoma, even in asymptomatic patients. Now, the next one, which is very interesting topic, is the incidentally discovered adrenal masses. You heard about before that those adrenal masses are discovered when we are asking for a CT scan or an ultrasound for an unrelated reason. We expect the patient with a gallstone or some kidney stone, and an ultrasound or CT is done, and unexpectedly the exam reveals adrenal tumors. And we know that even those patients are usually asymptomatic, about 8% of the patient will have pheochromocytoma. So it is a clear proposal and clear suggestion that all patients who have incidentally discovered adrenal masses should be screened for pheochromocytomas. And now the last one, which is in the list, is the idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy, which can be a symptom of pheochromocytoma, and patient with this disorder should be screened for pheochromocytoma. Now we are concentrating really the diagnostic approach, and it is very easy to make a list what is the task of the clinician who is working with patient with who have suspicion for pheochromocytoma. We have to do those four tasks. First, to have to make biochemical tests. We should measure catecholamines and catecholamine metabolites in a good assay. the second task is what we should do. We should find the pheochromocytoma, so we should use radiological localization methods. The third one is we should search for underlying genetic disorder. We now know that even patients who have no family history of pheochromocytoma may have syndromic or genetic form of pheochromocytoma, so syndromic hereditary forms of pheochromocytoma, and the percentage of those patients is quite high. In different statistics, it's about 25 and between 25% and 30%. So imagine that from 10 patients with pheochromocytoma, you will find three patients who have genetic disorder. And finally, this is a contradictory question, is the predict malignancy, which would be very important, but we have really very big problem with this task. Now we will look for those diagnostic tasks. So what are the possibilities to detect pheochromocytoma biochemically? So we can use blood measurements and urine measurements, and in blood we can measure free unconjugated epinephrine or epinephrine dopamine. We said that dopamine is probably not very important for the diagnosis of pheochromocytoma. And the reason is that dopamine is not very good, because you know from physiological studies that most of the dopamine within which it can be measured in the urine is produced in the kidney. So it not come from the even in patients with pheochromocytoma. There are also less important studies, chromogranin A, B, C. You know that chromogranin is a component of the secretory granules, and catecholamine-producing cells have secretory granules which secrete catecholamines and also chromogranin. And some other neuropeptides like neuropeptide Y or pancreostatin can be also used, but they are used only not very frequently in some, only in some laboratories. In the urine, you can measure metanephrines, normetanephrine, and metanephrines. We can measure free catecholamines, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Again, we were talking about vinyl mandelic acid, VME, and some metabolites of dopamine, which is probably clinically much, much less. Now, what is the outcome of those studies? Then we compare which is the best. For sure, we could use the best studies for the biochemical diagnosis. And this figure shows the specificity and sensitivity of the different catecholamine measurements. And here you see in green plasma metanephrines, in red plasma catecholamines, then urinary catecholamines and urinary vinyl mandelic acid. And you see that the best performance of those tests is plasma-free metanephrine, which is much better than plasma catecholamines or urinary catecholamines or urinary vinyl mandelic acid. It has the highest sensitivity and the highest specificity. Again, one other figure which compares, again, plasma-free metanephrine to urinary catecholamines or metabolites, and again, this is much better than the other two. So this would be the preferred measurements for the biochemical diagnosis of catecholamines. So this is just a summary. Which we recommend for routine evaluation are plasma and urine metanephrines with HPLC methods, and urine catecholamines, which are also good, and not recommended for routine evaluation is chromogranin A measurements, and we cannot recommend now provocative tests which were used in the older times, 20 or 30 years ago, when those precise catecholamine measurements were not available. So we don't use at present those tests. The only test what we still use, and we said that plasma catecholamines measurements are not very good for the diagnosis of pheochromocytoma. But there is one exception. One exception when we use clonidine tests, and this is really a very good test in those patients who we cannot decide whether the patient has pheochromocytoma or not. We can use this test, and here what we find in pheochromocytoma patients and in patients with essential hypertension. This shows the blood pressure, and the other lower part shows the plasma norepinephrine, epinephrine level. So we can conclude that the plasma norepinephrine and epinephrine measurements are not used, except when we use for the clonidine test, because it is very useful. When, if you give here before clonidine administration, after clonidine administration, the blood pressure decreases similar in patients with PHEO and in essential hypertension. It's the systolic, diastolic goes down in both groups. But when we measure plasma epinephrine and norepinephrine, then we see that in patients with PHEO, there is no decrease after clonidine, but with patients with essential hypertension, it is the high plasma norepinephrine, epinephrine is significantly decreased. So this test is used when other tests are not helping for the diagnosis. Now we turn back to the second task, the localization methods, and we have really many methods for the diagnosis of pheochromocytoma. And this shows the findings of the most important test. This is an abdominal CT scan. Here you see the liver, the spleen, this is the spine, and here you find the large tumor, and even you see that this is not a regular shape. It has some necrosis, and sometimes pheochromocytomas can be cystic. So if somebody look at this picture, can expect a malignant tumors, but from the CT appearance of the tumor in the case of pheochromocytoma, we cannot judge that the tumor is malignant or benign, and it can resemble really benign, very malignant tumors. Now the next one, which is very useful, is the MRA studies, and this shows that in certain MRA scanning, the tumor appears as a bright spot. So it has a hyper-intense signal, refers to pheochromocytoma. There are other studies which shows some more than the CT and the MRI scan, and we consider those studies as functional studies, and those are scintigraphic studies, and the upper part of this figure shows the MIBG scintigraphy, which is a catecholamine precursor. You know that catecholamine-producing cells are able not to produce catecholamines, but they take up catecholamines, and this MIBG. So it shows that the tumor is here. So, and we can be sure that this mass or lesion which accumulates this catecholamine precursor or catecholamine-like material has uptake mechanism. So it has a very high sensitivity and specificity for the diagnosis of pheochromocytoma. And there are more advanced methods, PET CT scan. You heard about this method, but usually the usual PET CT what we use in tumors are not useful for pheochromocytoma. We should use a special labeling material, and the labeling material, one of the labeling material is DOPA. We know that DOPA is a catecholamine precursor, so catecholamine-producing cell will take up these catecholamine precursors, and during PET exam, the tumor is visualized, and this patient has multiple pheochromocytomas, extradermal pheochromocytomas, and you see the dark spots in the different views of this picture. So how can we summarize the localization approach, what we should consider? First, what we should know that 90% of the pheochromocytomas are found in the adrenals. So the adrenals, it is really a target organ to find for pheochromocytomas. And we also know that pheochromocytomas, at least when they are causing symptoms, can be visible only with a simple ultrasound exam. So a good ultrasound can show the presence of a pheochromocytoma. We should use for not only ultrasound, but at least CT or MRI. And we should use also scanning, radiographic scanning methods, what we already showed, this MIBG or OctoScan or PET scan. And those are very useful when we expect multiple pheochromocytomas and extra-adrenal pheochromocytomas. We will talk later on this topic. So we should consider always that which is the most simple exam in a patient with hypertension who is expected for pheochromocytoma, just to ask for an abdominal ultrasound, and if the tumor is, as in 90% of the patient, is present in the adrenal, the ultrasound will find the tumor. Now we will search for our next task to search for a underlying cause. We mentioned already that there are genetic disorders which predispose to pheochromocytoma, and I already mentioned that 25-30% of the patient has genetic disorders behind pheochromocytoma. And I just want to show one large registry from Germany, Fairgood, and there were two studies, and in the first study was 207 cases with pheochromocytoma patient who had negative family history of pheochromocytoma. So no pheochromocytoma in family. And they found that when they made an extensive test for those disease-causing genes, the RET proto-oncogene, you know this is causing multiple endocrine neoplasia, neoplasia 2A and 2B, and VHL, which is the gene for von Hippel-Lindau disease, and also there are succinate dehydrogenase enzyme gene mutation. And when we look for all those genes, you will find patients with positive genetic tests in 24% of cases. So again, this is a large number, and it confirms what I said before. Now there is also a difference in the mean age of at the time of the diagnosis, because the patients who have those mutations have a less age. So the mean age in those patients who have those mutations and pheochromocytomas developed due to those genetic errors was 25 years, while in sporadic cases, the mean age was, at the time of diagnosis, about 44 years. So there is another study, again from the Freiburg Pheochromocytoma Registry, which included 461 cases with negative or positive family history, and there are also very important clinical findings at the time of the diagnosis. So when you find a patient who has an age below 10, then you will find patients with hereditary disorder in 70% of cases. When the patient under 18, 59% of cases are hereditary. And when the patient at the time of diagnosis has an age of 60 years, you will find no genetic cases. So we should consider pheochromocytoma in young age, which is very important. Also very important clinical finding, the prevalence or incidence of pheochromocytoma when not only one tumor is present, but when both adrenals are involved, or adrenals and extra-adrenal pheochromocytomas are present. And we see that in 89% of cases are hereditary. If the patient has multifocal or bilateral adrenal pheochromocytomas, which are very important information for the planning of the genetic testing. Now just to repeat again that which kind of genetic syndromes are associated with pheochromocytoma, we said that MEN2A and MEN2B, you know the other manifestation of those two disorders. The MEN2A is associated with medullary thyroid cancer and also primary hyperparathyroidism, in addition to pheochromocytoma, and MEN-B again, medullary thyroid cancer, pheochromocytoma, and those patients have a very typical phenotypic signs. You heard about this in previous lecture when the title of the lecture was the genetics of endocrine disorders. So the next one is von Hippel-Lindau disorder. You heard already that this disorder is caused by the von Hippel-Lindau gene, and it is characterized by multiple tumors within the kidney, within the brain, in the retina, in the pancreas, and in the adrenals. And the adrenal tumor is always pheochromocytoma. And finally, there is a group of familial paraganglioma syndromes, and the genes which are associated with these disorders are just expandings, and even a few years ago were new genes discovered, and we know that at least five genes which can be cause this hereditary disorder. Now the prediction of malignancy. I said that this is really a very problematic question, and just this is the summary what we can say, that how can we predict malignancy? If a pheochromocytoma is benign or malignant, what are the clinical findings? And I can say that the only one what we can trust is the presence of metastasis. When the patient has a metastatic disease, then we can be sure that the pheochromocytoma is malignant. There are some clinical data which may have limited usefulness, and those are the extra adrenal location of the tumors. They are more frequently malignant than adrenal pheochromocytomas. If the tumor is large, then there is a more risk for malignancy. And if the tumor has necrosis or increased serum chromogranin A, may propose some way the presence of malignancy, but those are inferior to the first one, the presence of metastasis, which is really the, I can say, the only proof that the pheochromocytoma is malignant. Now, what about the histopathological findings? We can say that the classical histological features of malignancy in pheochromocytoma is not really good, and we cannot trust with those results, even if we look for the nuclear hyperchromasia, pleomorphies, vascular invasion, which are used for other other tumors to predict malignancy. Those just doesn't work for pheochromocytoma. And to demonstrate that this is what I am seeing really true, I will show one proposal, and its clinical evaluation of this proposal. And this score system was developed in 2002, and it was published in a scientific newspaper. And the score of this pathological evaluation is, we call it PASS score, pheochromocytoma of the adrenal gland scale score, and you will see the different histological features and the numbers which are given if this feature is present or not. And when the sum of those which are present is higher than 4, then this classification is proposing that the tumor has a high metastatic potential, and if it is below low, then we can say, or at least this proposal says, that it has a risk for low metastatic potential. But now look how it works in the practice, and we see that it is quite confusing when the in the practice we try to use it. And what in this study we're doing is that they have chosen 60 tumors, and those numbers are the individual tumors, and they find five pathologists to evaluate the PASS score. And here we see what how the pathologists evaluated those adrenal tumors. We see that pathologist 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you see that just a disaster what we see, that the same tumor in one pathology received, you know, one score, and the same tumor in from other pathologists received a 9 score. So in one pathologist has a low risk for malignancy, and the other evaluation had a high risk of malignancy. And we can follow all those, but this is really a very disappointing. And again, some summary of those data, and just the it shows the results of the different pathologies, the five pathologies, what I showed before. And you see that the third pathologist gave a last score for those tumors, the other pathologies for those tumors. So it is really very disappointing, this histopathological finding. And now we consider that we cannot trust the pathologic finding. Even the pathologist said that it is a benign tumor. Metastasis can develop over years. Or if the pathologist considers that the tumor is a malignant tumor, there is no proof that the metastasis will really develop during time. Now the next question is about what we should do with the patient. As I mentioned, the treatment is surgery, but those patients need preoperative treatment, and the reason for preoperative treatment is listed here. What we should do with the patient before surgery, and what are the reasons for preoperative surgery listed here. So we have to inhibit the end organ action of norepinephrine and epinephrine until the tumor proposal to save the patient from the severe complication. And all patients have hypovolemia. They in a hypovolemic state, so it's much better before surgery to correct hypovolemia. And preoperative treatment should consider this task for patients. Now, the preoperative treatment, we think, and there are proof that it really helps to prevent blood pressure control during surgery, and also to minimize the hypertensive attack and hypertensive paroxysm during surgery. We consider that pheochromocytoma surgery is still a high-risk surgery, even in our days when there are very advanced methods, including laparoscopic adrenalectomy, but it's still a high-risk surgery for the patient. What we use for preoperative treatment, here are the drugs which are listed. So the drugs which should be mentioned in the first place are alpha-adrenergic antagonist. We can use alpha-adrenergic antagonist plus beta-adrenergic antagonist, and to combine those two is the reason to decrease tachycardia and arrhythmia caused by increased norepinephrine secretion, because we know that one of the consequences of increased epinephrine secretion is to produce tachycardia and arrhythmia. We can use also calcium channel blockers, and also very important, as I mentioned, to correct hypovolemia. Now, what are the important clinical notes that we should consider when we are applying those drugs? This is always a rule that we should start the treatment with alpha agonist treatment and not with beta antagonist. And we never use beta antagonist as a first line treatment. And the reason is that if we use beta adrenergic antagonists without alpha blockers, then beta receptor antagonists can inhibit the presynaptic beta inhibitory receptors, beta inhibitory receptors. So inhibition of an inhibitory action will produce an increased catecholamine secretion. So beta blockers are able to produce without, if are given without alpha receptor blockers, are able to produce a hypertensive attack in a patient with a pheochromocytoma. Now we can use non-selective beta receptor antagonists without adrenergic antagonists. If we do this, then we have the chance to provoke a hypertensive crisis. Now, what are the drugs which we are used for alpha receptor blocking? The classical treatment is phenoxybenzamine, which is a non-competitive and non-selective inhibitor of alpha adrenergic receptors, which are used traditionally for the preoperative treatment. Its advantage is that it has a long half-life. It's about 24 hours. We know that the starting dose about 10 milligrams, and we titrate very slowly until the dose given here. And important that before surgery, it is usually given to at least for 2 weeks, and we should plan the surgery after 2 weeks of alpha receptor alpha receptor antagonist phentermine treatment. Now the other one are selective alkaloid adrenergic receptor antagonists. One is prazosin. We have less experience in pheochromocytoma, but doxazosin, which is again a selective alpha adrenergic receptor blockers, we use quite often for patients before surgery. It has a longer half-life. Again, a small starting dose, and we increase gradually the dose. And again, the patient should be treated at least for 2 weeks before surgery. If it is not enough, we can use other treatments. As I mentioned, we can use adrenergic antagonists, but always after introduction of the alpha adrenergic antagonist. And we use it for treatment of arrhythmias and tachycardia. Calcium channel blockers can be also used, and there is a special drug, metirosin, which is an inhibitor of catecholamine biosynthesis, but this drug is used mainly in patients who have malignant pheochromocytomas. Now, at the end of the presentation, I would like to show you a case history, and I will see that I will have some questions, and I will see how the information went to you. And this was a true case presented in our clinic. And the patient was a 45 years old woman who had a 4 years history of bitemporal headache, general weakness, palpitation and perspiration. And what happened a few months before the admission, the patient raised blood pressure was noted, and the treatment of ACE inhibitor and calcium channel blockers were very started. And what happened before the admission with the patient one day before, the patient during night awakened from sleep with a mid-epigastric pain, strong pulsation in the head, and the patient had vomiting. And the next morning, the blood pressure was very high, 200 per 100 mercury blood pressure. Now, electrocardiography, blood chemistry, and an abdominal ultrasound was performed by the family doctor, and the ECG result was, and the laboratory tests were also normal. Abdominal ultrasound showed a left ordinal mass, which was measured as a 3 centimeters mass in the ordinal tumor. So then the patient was admitted to our department and was examined, and on admission, no physical exam abnormality was found. Blood pressure was mildly increased. It was 150/19. But after the patient was admitted to the clinic, a few hours later, the patient developed a typical paroxysmal spell with sudden headache, visual changes, headache, epigastric pain and palpitation. And during the spell, heart rate was 128, and her blood pressure was 240/140. So it was a typical paroxysmal attack, what we expect in a patient who had paroxysmal hypertension. Now the patient was examined, and we sent the laboratory urine samples and also blood samples, and the routine chemistry was normal, including all those measurements, and the 24-hour urine at the time of the spell, and here are shown the results. Norepinephrine was more than 10 times than normal. Epinephrine was normal. Normetinephrine was about 4 or 3 times normal. And metanephrine was in the normal range, and VMI was also increased about 3 times more than the upper limit of range. And the CT scan was done. And as the ultrasound showed, the patient had a left adrenal mass, and I show you the finding, and here the tumor. Here you see the liver, the spine, the stomach, and the liver, and here this adrenal tumor, which measuring about 3 centimeters of size, and we see that the signal intensity of this tumor is lower than the liver, so it is a hypodense lesion. Now the patient has typical clinical signs of pheochromocytoma with paroxysmal attack. During the attack, the patient has increased catecholamine and catecholamine metabolite secretion, and we found an adrenal tumors. So may I ask, what would be your proposal? I can propose 3 options. The first one would be that the patient should be sent to surgery for operating by laparoscopic adrenalectomy, and then the problem of the patient will be solved. Can you raise the hands who agrees this proposal? So those findings, the patient should be sent to the surgeon and operate the surgeon immediately. Who agrees with this proposal? Anybody? One? No more. So you said that ask the surgeon, send the patient and operate. Okay. So I am asking that before sending the surgeon, maybe you will change your proposal. Before sending the surgeon, we should give the patient alpha-adrenergic blockers for 2 weeks and then refer the surgery department and ask the surgeon to operate the patient and do an endoscopic laparotomy. Who agrees with this? Can you raise your hands? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 13. So as I count, it's about 55 students propose that in this case, the patient should be sent to surgery, but just after 2 weeks of preoperative treatment. Okay? But what should propose, what would be the third proposal? To do a PET scan. MRI. Pardon? Okay, so you were listening to the lecture, because what we expect in patients who have a pheochromocytoma in the adrenal, we said that the patient should have a high increase of epinephrine and epinephrine metabolite metanephrine. And if you go back the results, and this patient had a increased norepinephrine, normetanephrine, and vanil mandelic acid, which we know comes from both epinephrine and norepinephrine. But epinephrine and metanephrine secretion are normal in the urine. So what would think about this this finding? That it should be an extra-adrenal tumor. And it, in the adrenal is something different. So I am think that you are right, because we made some extra exams, and what we did, an X-ray, an MRI scan of the chest, and we found that this shows the MRI scan that a large tumor in the paraaortic region is present on the MRI scan, and we also did a MIBG scintigraphy, which we said that this is a functional exam for pheochromocytoma, and we found no uptake in the adrenal region, and we found an isotope accumulation in the mediastinal region. So what will be the final diagnosis? That the pheochromocytoma was in the mediastinum. It was an extra-adrenal para-aortic pheochromocytoma or paraganglioma. And what was in the left adrenal? This was an adrenal incidentaloma. As you heard before in your lectures, in certain age, the incidence of adrenal incidentalomas is very high. In an older age, can reach as 5 or 8% of the subjects who are undergoing CT or ultrasound exam. So this finding in this patient was an extra-adrenal pheochromocytoma, and the adrenal lesion was an adrenal incidentaloma. So just to summarize the lesson from what we can learn from this case story, again, what we should emphasize that extra-adrenal pheochromocytoma secrete norepinephrine, and an adrenal pheochromocytoma secrete both epinephrine and norepinephrine. And epinephrine secretion may be explained by the induction of the conversion of the enzyme which converts norepinephrine to epinephrine. And the other lesson to be learned from this case, that on unenhanced CT scan, when the attenuation of the tumor is about 10 Hounsfield unit, it is typical for a lipid-rich benign adrenocortical adenomas and not for pheochromocytomas. And just again, I show you the CT scan. And if you look at the CT scan, you see that it is really a hypo-intense lesion within the, compared to the liver. So it is typical adrenal incidentalomas which are cortical origin and usually secrete no hormones, no steroid hormones, and for sure not catecholamines. So now we finish with this topic, and I thank you for your attention, and we will